I was like, I think I was 12 or 13.
I'd like to welcome you to the Southern Region RAC meeting this evening. We appreciate your attendance. Before we get started, I'd like to recognize two of our board members that are in the audience. We have Jake Albrecht, who's the chairman of the Wildlife Board, that's here. And we also have Steve Dalton that's here with us. We appreciate them attending. Appreciate the work they do as board members. I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Dave Black from St. George and the Southern RAC chairman. And maybe I could start down on my far right, and we'll have the RAC members introduce themselves and who they represent.
I'm Claire Woodbury from Hurricane. I represent the public at large.
I'm Cordell Pearson from Circleville, and I represent public at large.
Lane Torgerson from Richfield. I'm a sportsman's representative.
Mike Staley from Delta. I'm at large.
Rusty Aiken from Cedar City Agriculture.
I'm Kevin Bunnell. I'm the regional supervisor for the Division of Wildlife for the Southern Region.
Brian Johnson. I'm from Enoch, Utah. I represent the non-consumptives.
Mac Morrell Bicknell, representing agriculture.
Sean Kelly from Fillmore, representing Forest Service.
Dale Bagley from Marysville, I represent an elected official.
Thank you. Looks like most of you have been to a RAC meeting before, but just real briefly on the order of the meeting. As we go through the presentations, following each presentation, there'll be questions that be asked from the RAC. And then there'll be an opportunity for questions from the public. And at that point, we want you to limit your comments to questions. Following the question period, then we'll have a comment period. And in order for the public to comment, please get one of the comment cards and provide those to one of the DWR representatives, and they'll bring them up to us. And we'll allow 5 minutes per comment. And then we'll ask for any comments from the RAC. And following the comments, we'd proceed for motions and votings. First order of business that we have is to approve the agenda and the minutes. Do we have a motion from the RAC to do so?
I'd like to make a motion that we accept the agenda and the minutes from the last RAC meeting.
Okay, we have a motion from Lane and a second from Rusty. All those in favor? Any opposed? Okay, that's unanimous. The next item is to provide a wildlife board meeting update. I was at the board meeting last week, and just in summary, for the most part, the Wildlife Board approved the recommendations from the division with the following exceptions. At the Southwest Desert area for the limited entry bulls, instead of increasing the number of bulls by 10, they left the number of bulls in that area the same, and they increased the number of cows by 60 over and above what was recommended by the division. Also, there was a lengthy discussion about Southwest Desert area regarding the horses and the number of horses in the area. And there was a letter that had been drafted from the division to present that letter to the BLM with our concerns about the habitat and the negative impacts that the horses were having in that area. Also, with regards to the Paunsagunt and the Henry Mountain deer recommendations, they elected not to increase the number of tags and to use the 2013 tag numbers for this, for 2014. And then there was also a lengthy discussion about the drought that we're in, especially here in southern Utah, and what's projected throughout this summer. And what was discussed was, which I was impressed with, is at each of the upcoming board meetings, there will be a discussion on how the range is doing and a discussion on the possibility of maybe having to increase the number of cow tags on an emergency basis to pull some of the animals off these areas that would be heavily impacted by the drought. And so in the June meeting and in the August meeting, that will be on the agenda, and there may be some recommendations at that time to increase cow tag numbers in specific areas. I'll turn the time over to Kevin for an update.
All right, thank you, Dave. I'll just run through each of our sections and give you an update on what's going on. From our aquatic section, the higher elevation lakes are coming, the ice is coming off early this year, and recent reports from the Boulder Mountain is that on many of those lakes the ice is off and the fishing has been very good. The ice is off of Fish Lake, which is earlier than normal, and fishing should be very good. Ice is also off Navajo, but unfortunately it appears that we may have had a significant winter kill on Navajo, which I know a lot of my staff is heartbroken over, because they love going up there and catching big splake this time of year. But we'll know more about that. They're actually going to set nets and assess that situation later this week. But early indications aren't good, and that lake has a history of doing that occasionally, and it's unfortunate that it probably happened this year. Panguitch Lake. They actually did the survey on that today, and it looked very good. I expect fishing on Panguitch Lake to be similar to previous years, which has been very good. From our law enforcement staff, the focus continues to be trying to contain the quagga mussels to Lake Powell now that we know that they're there. And so there's a lot of effort going into working on the boat ramps, and there's been some administrative checkpoints along Highway 89 coming out of Waweep and then coming out of Bullfrog. We will be shifting our efforts actually to the ramps with law enforcement officers beginning this weekend, while the Park Service is in the process of kind of changing their direction, going more from prevention to containment. And that'll continue to be an evolving situation as we try to protect the rest of the waters in Utah from having getting quagga mussels. From our wildlife section, they're in the middle of their spring range assessments, which may become very important this year to give us an idea of where we're starting the year in terms of habitat conditions if you know, water conditions continue to be poor. There's also, you know, last weekend there was also a big project in cooperation with SFW in planting a bunch of bitterbrush on the Parowan front at some of that range that we've been concerned about and been removing deer off, and we appreciate the efforts there. From our habitat section, relative to what Dave mentioned in terms of kind of following the conditions of habitat through this summer, they've put together a kind of a drought assessment plan for the region. Right now primarily focused on the Southwest Desert, because that's where the issue is most acute. But we'll also be staying in close contact with the federal land management agencies and making sure we're if we need to make additional recommendations to make sure that we're not damaging habitat, we will do that as the summer progresses. And then lastly, from the habitat section, Gary just wanted me to mention that our seasonal road closures on our wildlife management areas ended April 30th, so access to the wildlife management areas is now open. So that's all I have, Dave, but I'd be glad to take any questions if there are any.
Okay. Before we move to the first action item and presentation, I also wanted to mention that two of our RAC members were at the board meeting. Mike was there and had some comments, and we appreciate him for going up there and expressing those comments. I felt like the board was very attentive to his concerns, also to the concerns of the is it the Cattlemen's Association? Who was the representative there? Yeah, I thought he did an excellent job in some of his comments. And then we also had Mike Worthen was there and commented on the wild horse issue. So we appreciate them going to Salt Lake and their comments and again the work that they do as RAC members and the concerns that they have. So it looks like our first action item then is we're on item number 5, be the turkey management plan by Jason Robinson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. As you see from the agenda, you're going to be hearing from me for a little while. But if everything goes well tonight, hopefully you won't see me for a couple of years. So we'll see how it goes. I'm Jason Robinson. I'm the Upland Game Coordinator at the Salt Lake office. I'm going to talk to you about the Utah Wild Turkey Management Plan. So there was an existing management plan approved by the board in 2000. Had 4 goals within that plan. And what we found was much of the information was outdated or the objectives had been met. And we also know a lot more about wild turkeys in Utah now than we did in 2000, which ultimately meant we needed to update this plan. And so the division put together an advisory committee to help us work through this revision of the plan, included a diverse group of folks, included the DWR, Salt Lake office, all 5 regions were represented, Outreach and Habitat, the National Wild Turkey Federation, both the state, regional, and national level were in attendance, SFW, Chucker Foundation, BLM, Forest Service, the Wildlife Board, RAC, private landowners, interested sportsmen, Farm Bureau. NRCS was invited, but they declined, as well as United Wildlife Cooperative. So we had a pretty diverse group to help us work through this management plan. We began meeting in December of 2013. We had 5 total meetings. Last meeting ended in mid-March. So we had basically 20 total meeting hours plus homework. So a lot of the time the committee members would be assigned tasks that they would go work on in between each of those meetings. So we're proposing a 6-year plan with a 3-year renewal option at the end of that 6 years. Basically, it syncs with the 3-year guidebook, is why we did 6 and 9. The plan provides basic background, basic biology, habitat needs, some information to harvest, and then links to data so that this plan is references up-to-date information. So in 6 years from now, they can still use that link to get to the most recent and up-to-date data. We revised the wild turkey occupied habitat map, and so this is a view of that. The bright blue represents turkey habitat. We compared this with the last plan, and we've expanded turkey populations quite a bit in Utah, which is a great success story. You know, turkeys were historically here in Utah, and we've been able to bring them back, and they're doing quite well, which is pretty great. So this plan has 5 goals. The first goal is to maintain and improve wild turkey populations to habitat or social carrying capacity, minimize human wild turkey conflicts, improve wild turkey hunting opportunities, enhance the appreciation of wild turkeys in Utah, and enhance our interagency cooperation. So goal A had 3 objectives there. You can see basically stabilize declining populations, do some habitat work to improve both the quality and quantity of wild turkey habitat, and then establish wild turkey populations in 80 new sites by 2020. Goal B has just 2 objectives, decrease the number of chronic material damage complaints, and the phrase material damage comes right out of wildlife code from some legislation that was passed last year. Can you hear me? Is that working? Okay. And then the other one was decrease the number of chronic nuisance complaints. We wanted to separate those. The material damage, the division has a legal obligation to respond to those within 72 hours. And then nuisance complaints we will respond to. And we wanted to decrease those by 25%. So that as the turkey population grows in the state, which we're hoping to do, we'll still be responsive to those complaints. Improve wild turkey hunting opportunities. We wanted to increase accessible hunting areas within a 1 hour drive of the Wasatch Front. This is to get at that increasing number of turkey hunters. Most people live within an hour of the Wasatch Front. And then increase the number of permits sold statewide to basically a 20% increase from last year. And then under Goal D, we had two objectives. Education is always important, especially with wild turkeys. You know, they're expanding, they're growing, they're kind of new for some folks as they've expanded. So we want to educate people about the facts on turkeys. And then the increased number of participants at wild turkey events. This can be SFW events, NWTF events, just whatever, viewing events. So we want to increase people's exposure to turkeys. Goal E, which is enhanced interagency cooperation. Basically hold an interagency meeting once a year for each of the five DWR regions, just to keep in touch with other regions and within agencies, you know, Forest Service, BLM. These turkeys are used in a lot of different habitats as they go through their yearly cycle. So just kind of keeping in touch with everybody. That's all I had. Thank you.
Do I have any questions from the RAC?
I'm not sure. It might come up later, but I read that you are discontinuing the landowner draw. Or is there still going to be landowner tags, or is that done away with? What's going on there?
We can either talk about it now, or it comes up in the guidebook portion, whatever you'd prefer. Okay.
Do you have any questions from the public? We have a comment card.
Paul, yours says crows, turkeys, etc. Are you interested in commenting on the plan or on the recommendations? Okay.
Okay, do we have any comments from the RAC? Looks like we're ready to entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion that we approve the turkey management plan as proposed.
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion from Dale to approve the management plan as proposed. A second from Sean. Do we have any discussion on the motion? Okay, all those in favor? Is that unanimous? Okay, thank you. All right, we're ready to move on to item number 6, which is the turkey transplant proposed list.
Okay, the next item is a wild turkey transplant recommendation. So transplant list is required by wildlife code for moving wild turkeys here in Utah. We sent the proposed transplant list through the RDCC and local governments to provide input on that. We did receive comments back from 6 counties. None had any opposition to the transplant list. One of the things we want to make a point of is we're still trying to grow the Utah wild turkey population. The plan that you just approved, management plan, goal A, was to grow wild turkeys here in the state of Utah, and this is our main way of doing that. The current approved transplant list expires in June of 2014, so we have a current transplant list that expires this year. We are recommending a 5-year transplant list, so it would expire June of 2019. This transplant list was developed at a regional level by the local biologists. We want to move these birds to areas with a low likelihood of conflict. We can't always guarantee that, but we try and plan ahead as much as we can to try and reduce those human-wildlife conflicts. And we also see this as a tool to help us reduce human-turkey conflicts. As an example, we moved several hundred birds in the northern region out to the northeast region, so we could take them from places where maybe people were complaining about them to areas where they were very unlikely to run into anyone. So we have on this transplant list 235 total proposed sites. 106 of those sites are new. 129 of those sites are existing sites, so they've had turkeys released in the past. We just want to supplement them. Either the population's too low or we want to increase the genetic diversity. Three-fourths of the sites are for the Rio Grande subspecies and the other quarter for the Merriam subspecies. Here's the breakout per by region. So you can see the southern region has 57 proposed sites. Of those, 27, or just under half, are new sites. So about 50-50 new and existing sites for the southern region. That's all I have. Thank you.
Do I have any questions from the RAC? Cordell?
Now, your sites where you've had turkeys before, and it's been a pretty good population in the last 2 years, like City Creek, which is out of Junction, Birch Creek, which is out of Circleville.
Okay.
I mean, I'm up there all the time, and I have not seen a turkey in the last 2 years. I'm sure there's a few there, but there's very few. The other one is Marysville Canyon. I drive that road every day, and I used to see turkeys all the time. I no longer see any turkeys. Does that mean they've moved, or does that mean that we've had a problem with them and they're all dead? And have you looked at any of those sites about transplanting turkeys in there?
I'll have one of the local biologists to know the area a little bit better, try and address some of those concerns, if that's all right.
What area?
Circleville, Marysville.
So the Marysville Canyon turkeys, they used to be fun to watch. The winter of 2010, that reduced that population severely. At least that's when they disappeared at that time period. And so, and I haven't noticed them in there since. And so, but I don't think that's on the current transplant list. But
what about you cover City Creek and Birch Creek too?
Josh, you have a little info on that?
I don't cover it where it's on the beaver, but I was the CO up there, and it's the same thing that Vance said in 2010, 2011, when we had all that snow, we lost a lot of birds that were in there. So I don't know if it's on the transplant list or not. Riley covers the beaver, but I know that's why a lot of those birds in that area died was from that winter.
Okay, so my next question to you is, are you going to look at those areas that have had turkeys for years and now have none when you do this transplant?
Yeah, so within the management plan that we just passed, one of the objectives is to look at these areas where we have declining populations and try and identify what may have caused that, and then look at options. If it's habitat, try and create habitat. If it's some kind of severe winter, look at importing birds, transplants. So that's part of the plan, and part of our strategy is if it's good habitat, the one thing we've got to make sure we do is try and identify why the birds aren't there now and make sure that it's still a good turkey site, which I think these areas are, and then identify what we need to do to make sure that they stay there.
Jason, on this transplant list, will some of these birds, I know that one of the concerns of the division is the depredating and the nuisance birds. Is that where some of these transplant birds will come from?
Yeah. So the example I gave of the northern region were areas where, like the town of Minden has a whole bunch of turkeys that come out of, in the winter. So we've caught birds there and then transplanted them. One of the things that people get concerned if they're kind of bad birds, if they're going to be bad, where we put them in a new area. And often what we've found is if you put them in an area that has sufficient habitat, a lot of the time they don't become bad birds somewhere else kind of thing. So, and we're pretty careful to make sure we put these birds in areas where we're hoping they won't become an issue.
And Lane, just for your guys' information, we moved, I think, 500 birds within the region this year, a bunch out of Parowan and a bunch out of Enterprise that were, they were in town causing problems, you know, crapping on people's front porches and stuff. And, you know, so we're pretty active doing that within the region of moving them out to areas where they're not going to have conflicts and, you know, putting them in areas where we need to supplement or start new populations. So.
So could I ask Kevin, in areas like the Cordell is mentioning, can they be supplemented without being on this transplant list and with these nuisance birds?
Well, I would say the safest thing, and Jason, correct me if I'm wrong, if you have areas that you would like to see on that list, I'd make that part of your motion as you address this agenda item to add those. To, if there's areas that you think ought to be added to the list, that you include that in a motion, that's probably the safest way to have it covered.
Yeah.
Mark.
There we go. I was looking on our stuff that was sent out on the initial transplant or the supplemental transplant. I don't see any down in the southern region, down on the Fremont River, down in that Canesville area. And they've got a bunch of turkeys there. I don't know where they came from. Old John Jackson, he's having quite a problem down there. And I don't go down there very often. I just happened to go down to church in Hanksville one Sunday, and there was about 200 or 300 birds all through that country there. So I don't know where they came from, but it's not on your transplant list. They must have, Jim, they know, maybe he knows.
I'll leave it to you.
They came there in 1993. That was a really old list. That's where they came from.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So are you wondering the transplant?
Yeah, I was going to say, I was about to call John, but maybe we want to transplant some out of there. Yeah.
So this transplant list covers where they go to. It doesn't cover where we capture them from, if that makes sense. So
what do we need to do to add something to capture from?
Tell Jim.
Okay.
We don't need that on a list, Mac. If there's a problem, we can go address it without it being on a list.
Not a question, but on some of your transplant sites, it looks like you got their own counties. Not that it matters, but like Monroe Dry Creek and Marysville Dry Creek, showing severe counties, should be Paiute on those. Pole Canyon, not that it's a big issue.
Yeah. We can either have you guys correct those or work with our local folks to get it corrected for the board.
Do we have any additional questions from the RAC? Do we have any questions from the public? Please come forward.
I just wonder if I could get Matt's help. I've tried to get permission down there to hunt with my kids. And
you need to state your name.
Oh, Scott Christensen. Is there any way you could help me facilitate some of that access so we could bring some hunters in there?
Down to Canesville?
Yeah. I mean, that would be great because we've asked before and we've been asked, yeah, better not. But I don't know all the landowners down there, but yeah, if you could help us, we'd love it. We'd love to go hunt those birds. So we'll do it. Thank you.
Do you have a comment card? Oh, that's it? Okay, we have Scott's comment card. Was that your comment, Scott?
Yeah.
Okay. We don't have any additional comment cards. Do we have any comments from the right? Looks like we're ready to entertain a motion on this item.
I think maybe Cordell, if you could add your items in there, that'd be good.
Okie doke, I'll do it. Okay, I'd like to make a motion that we approve the plan presented by DNR. But I'd also like to, and I don't know if I amend that at this point in time, that we include Marysville Canyon, Birch Creek out of Circleville, and City Creek out of Junction up Highway 153.
So that's good, just like that. It just make that's part of the motion is to approve it with the addition of those three sites. Okay.
Then we have a second on that motion. Is there any discussion? With an amendment.
I'd like to make an amendment to include the Mammoth Creek, the upper stretches of the Sevier, and the Minersville and Beaver drainages. And Coal Creek. Throw Coal Creek in there.
Somebody keeping track of all this? Because I'm passing mics back.
Okay, we also have a second on the amendment. Do we have any discussion on the amendment?
In the plan, I think the DWR is studying the sites, and I'm wondering if instead of just saying let's transplant them there, maybe these aren't suitable. I don't know, but that should be addressed before the transplant, I think. Okay, that was my comment.
Do we have any further discussion? Okay, so we need to address the amendment first. So we'll vote on the amendment. And the amendment was to include...
Steph? Just the amendment.
Upper stretches of the Sevier, Minersville, and Beaver, and Coal
Creek. Okay. All in favor? Looks like motion carries. Now we'll address the main motion, which is to include the plan as presented with the addition of Birch Creek, City Creek, and Marysville Canyon. All those in favor? Motion carries. Okay, we're ready to move on to the next item, which is number 7, which is the Upland Game, Turkey, and Crane 3-year recommendations.
So I'm actually not going to cover cranes. That'll be covered in the migratory game portion that Blair will do, but the other portions, the upland game and turkey in this one. Okay, just a little bit of background on upland game, just to kind of give you a perspective as we move through these recommendations. Upland game generally experience boom and bust cycles. Annual survival can be as short as 2 years. You take like a pheasant, it only lives, you know, a year, maybe 2 years. Populations are largely dependent upon annual production. So they have a whole bunch of babies. They don't live very long, but they have a whole bunch of chicks or young. Natural annual survival rates can be very low as 10%. So only 10% of the population makes it to the one-year mark. So you can see very up and down populations. Hunter harvest generally accounts for only 10% of the population. And then population cycle largely independent of hunter harvest. So these populations go up and down regardless of how many birds we're harvesting. This law of diminishing return influences hunter interest. So in those years where the populations are really low, a hunter might go out and not see very many birds, tells his buddies, so they don't go out. It's not worth their time. But in the years when there's a lot of birds, tell their buddies, they all go out because there's a lot of birds. And so there's this kind of inherent protection. In low years, not as many hunters go out. Season length and bag limits spread harvest and opportunity. So we have long seasons, liberal bags, to try and take advantage of these good years. And so what this all kind of boils down to is a three-year guidebook does make biological sense for upland game management. We don't want to be trying to chase those highs and responding to those lows. If we have consistent regulations, hunters will kind of help regulate harvest based on these basic criteria. So moving into the recommendations, throughout my presentation, anything highlighted in that bright yellow is a change from the last three-year guidebook. So we want to change the definition of youth to be consistent with the big game. So youth is now defined as anyone 17 years old or younger on July 31st. So just kind of makes it a little bit older. In the past, it's been 15 years. So a little more opportunity. And that's kind of a common thing throughout this is we want to increase opportunity. So moving into the species-specific recommendations, quail, area statewide, season dates are the same. The one change from the last three-year cycle is we would like to increase the one-day youth hunt, which was on a Saturday, to a three-day youth hunt, which would be Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And we'll do this for a variety of species. So we have an existing one-day. We'd like to extend that to a three-day. And again, it's just opportunity. With chuckers and pheasants, we put out some pen-reared birds. We just want youth to have more opportunity to be able to harvest those birds. There's, sporting events, church, all those things. So it just gives us more opportunity for the youth to be able to get out and enjoy upland game hunting. And then everything else is the same as the last three-year cycle. Moving into the partridge, one thing that you'll see is we formerly referred to it as Hungarian partridge. The correct name is gray partridge. They're from Hungary. That's why where the Hungarian came from. We would like to correct that throughout the guidebook and in the rule to gray partridge. Same thing here. There's no changes to the season dates or areas. Again, we would like to do a three-day youth hunt. So a Saturday, Sunday, Monday, generally the prior to the general season, for the same reasons as the quail hunt. Cottontail rabbits, no changes from the last three-year cycle. Dusky and ruffed grouse, again, no changes to these regulations from the last three-year cycle. Greater sage grouse, we would like to continue with a permit allocation based on population estimates from let counts. So we count the birds in the spring, and then we recommend a number of permits for that fall based on those spring counts. And that's not to be more than two birds harvested per year per hunter and less than 10% of the population. Most of the state is closed to sage-grouse hunting. We have four areas open. On a statewide average, we actually only harvest less than 3% of the total birds in the state. So very conservative sage-grouse harvest. And some of the reasons for doing a sage-grouse hunt, collect data. We get wings from those birds. Allows biologists to keep in touch, keep track of the populations. It also provides a funding source we can use matching funds from Pittman-Robertson dollars, so helps with management to maintain this hunt. We'd like to allocate 15% of the permits to youth, which is not a change. One change that we're proposing this year is to discontinue the 10% allocation to falconers. We would like falconers to draw those permits in the regular draw, like everybody else. I've seen a few confused looks, so maybe I'll go into a little bit. What we've done in the past is set aside 10% of the permits for falconers to just come pick up. They don't have to go through the draw process. And so what we would like to do is have falconers also apply and compete with gun hunters, basically, for those permits. So as far as areas, season dates, bag limits, not proposing any changes. The same areas, same seasons as the last three-year guidebook. ring-necked pheasants. Area would be statewide. So one of the changes we would like to propose from, it's a change from the last three-year guidebook, is we have a general hunt that occurs the first 2 weeks, so from the first Saturday in November to the third Sunday in November. It's all lands are open. Where the change we're proposing this year is there's an extended season for the next 2 weeks. So from the first Saturday in November to the first Sunday in December, those last 2 weeks we would like to close private lands and just have it open on public lands. What this allows us to do is we've been putting out a lot of pen-reared pheasants in areas, and we would like to be able to allow our WMAs and state-owned land open longer for people to be able to hunt those birds. The past, we closed certain counties to that extended season, so we'd just like to open all counties to that extended season. So just, again, offering some more opportunity. And there's been some concern about the bird numbers, but with private lands being closed, it acts as kind of a refuge for those birds. So that last 2 weeks, private lands are closed. The other change we're proposing, again, is the youth day. We would like to have the one-day youth hunt be a three-day youth hunt. So, again, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Moving on to sharp-tailed grouse. We'd like to continue with the permit allocation system, very similar to the sage grouse permit system. We count the birds in the spring, recommend permits in the fall based on those counts. So if the population goes up, permits go up. If the population goes down, the permits go down. Allocate 15% of the permits to the youth. The areas and seasons, we're not proposing any changes to the areas or season dates from the last three-year guidebook. Snowshoe hare, not recommending any changes from the last three-year guidebook. White-tailed ptarmigan, again, we're not recommending any changes from the last three-year guidebook. Moving into wild turkeys. So we would like to continue with a regional limited entry hunt followed by a statewide over-the-counter general season. We'll continue to evaluate harvest and hunter data. We'd like to keep a three-year average of hunter success greater than 20%, hunter crowding less than 4 on a 1-5 scale, hunter satisfaction greater than 2 on a 1-5 scale. And these are conducted post-hunt surveys that we do. Again, continue with the youth hunt, 15% over the counter, 15% of the permits go to youth in the limited entry, and then the youth get a three-day over the counter season prior to the general over the counter season. We would recommend discontinuing the limited entry landowner permits. What we've seen when we evaluated the data for the limited landowner permits is of the 500 permits available, 33 are being used. So very little. That's 6% utilization rate. What we've found is a landowner can actually get an over-the-counter permit for less money because you have to pay the tag fee plus an application fee. It's a lot of work for both our area biologists as well as our Salt Lake office to maintain that program, and we're just not seeing utilization. When we went with the over-the-counter season, we saw that most landowners were just buying a over-the-counter permit because they can control access to their private lands and harvest a bird that way. And then we would also like to offer a fall hunting season in limited areas, and I'll go into a little more detail on that. So for the spring wild turkey hunt recommendation, we would like to offer an extension for hunters with disabilities. They can apply for an extension for qualifying disabilities. Limited entry regional hunt would be the second Saturday to the last Thursday in April. And then what we would like to start doing is implementing an annual limited entry permit allocation system. Basically real similar to the what we do for greater sage grouse and sharp-tailed grouse, where we'd look at population trend, where the population's going up, hunter success rates, crowding, all those other things, to come up with a recommended permit. What we'd hope to do is have the RAC approve the process like you do for sage grouse, and then we wouldn't come to you each year with the number of permits. You would recommend the process, just like the sage grouse and sharp-tailed grouse. And so that 2014 example, we ran this through the system to see how the permits came out for the 2014 season. It's obviously already happened, but just to kind of give you guys an idea of how that permit system compares to what the number of permits we recommended in the past. And you can see it's fairly consistent with maybe some additional opportunity that we haven't been taking advantage of, especially down here in the southern region. We've got an increasing turkey population, large expanse of turkey populations. So maybe we, based on this permit system, we should be able to offer more permits without having any impact on the resource. And then we would continue with the over-the-counter statewide hunt. Again, the youth get a three-day hunt last Friday in April through Sunday. And then the rest of the hunters would have Monday following the youth hunt to May 31st. No change there. So the fall wild turkey hunt recommendation. So this is new. The entire hunt's new. So the main objective of this fall hunt is to reduce human-turkey conflicts. Remember from the management plan, that's an emphasis for the division. One thing we want to keep in mind is fall hunts can reduce populations. They're either sex hunts, so you can harvest hens. So we've got to be fairly careful on how we do that because we still do want to grow turkey populations in the state. So a person would apply for a regional permit, so they would apply for a southern region permit. And if they were successful, there would be certain areas within the region that would be open, not the entire region. So it would be sub areas. A person could hunt in any one of those areas within the region, but not other regions. And I have a kind of an illustration of how that would work. Regions, the local region would determine the areas to have the hunt, the number of permits, and the season dates. And those season dates could be anywhere from November 1st through February 28th. They would be determined annually, so to try and address these problem areas. Take some birds out where they're causing issues. Again, what we would like is the board to approve this process. So we would set these parameters, and what that would allow us to do is we wouldn't have to come back to the board each and every year, and it allows us to have some flexibility to deal with problem areas within the same year that we're having those problems. So it gives us a little more focused adaptive management. We would also use a permit allocation system for those. There would be no point system for the fall hunts. So the easiest way to think about this is the turkey hunt in the spring is kind of all on its own. So none of the points carry over into the fall, none of the permits carry over in the fall. There's a spring hunt and there's a fall hunt that are very separate. And so a person would apply for a spring permit, and they could also apply for a fall permit and harvest a bird in both spring and fall. The fall hunt would be in any turkey permit, so male or female. We would set aside 15% to go to the youth. We've kind of worked through this just to kind of give you an example of what we would propose for the fall of 2014, just so you kind of have a feel for how many permits we're talking here. So this is for the fall of 2014. Two of the five regions are recommending permits. The northern region recommending 73, and the southern region 220. Which is very similar to the number of birds that each of those regions have. So here's an example from the northern region. So if a person applied for a northern region tag, they were successful, they would be able to hunt within those green areas, any of those bright green areas within the northern region with that permit. The hunt dates would be November 1st through December 31st, and again, 73 permits for the entire region. Moving on to the falconry recommendation, we would like to recommend a September 1 to February 28th date statewide and allow falconry on fall wild turkey hunts. A falconer would have to draw that permit through the process. So we have a few board action items to present. We do not recommend allowing falconry on wild turkeys in the spring, but allow for fall turkey season. We recommend a person can use a 10 to a 28 gauge to hunt turkeys. Group applications up to four for turkeys. We also are recommending that youth hunters that are unsuccessful in harvesting a turkey during the spring limited entry to be able to then use that same permit to hunt the spring over-the-counter season. We do not recommend that for adults, so it'd just be for those youth 17 and younger. And then also allow crossbows to hunt wild turkeys and upland game, which is consistent with other hunts here in the state. And then we have a few changes to the upland game rule to implement this. Made some minor wording adjustments, corrected species names. I mentioned the gray partridge. Blue grouse is now known as dusky grouse. Just kind of some of those things that just kind of cleaning it up. Adjustments to the legal weapons. Clarification and consistency on the use of dogs on WMAs. We wanted to make it more clear on when a person could or couldn't train dogs on our wildlife management areas. We added the American crow to the list of migratory upland game birds. You'll hear the actual proposal from the migratory bird coordinator here, Blair, but it's part of this rule, so I mentioned it here, but you'll hear the full proposal coming up. And then again with wild turkeys, made adjustments to make this, if this passes, so removing the landowner permits section, adjustments to falconry, adjustments to the legal weapons, and again, clarification and consistency on the use of dogs on WMAs. That's all I have. Thank you.
Do we have any questions from the right?
Yeah, I have one. Well, we're going to vote on this, and then later on the curl thing's going to come up.
Correct.
So how are we going to approve this if we don't approve that? How can we vote on it first?
What we would recommend is approving it after you've heard the proposal from the migratory game bird coordinator. There are several species that fall within that program, and so there's a few species that you would approve through that process.
Okay, let me ask something about curls. Is it legal to hunt curls now?
It is not. Depending on, well, I'll let Blair answer that.
Yeah, it's currently not legal to hunt them or to kill them in any form, even if they're, you know, depredating or doing anything like that. So.
Is that like a federal statute or is that a state statute?
Yeah, and I can get into it a little bit more when I do the migratory upland game regulate.
Okay.
So. Sean, do you have a question?
Yeah, Jason, on the fall turkey hunt, when that overlaps big game months, will there be a hunter orange requirement for people draw that tag?
We didn't have that in there, but that's something we'll have to. One of the things we'll have to do is make sure we're consistent with a lot of the other laws and regulations. So we'll have to look at that specifically.
And it says you recommend a 10 to 28 gauge, so hunting the rifles will not, or centerfire rifles won't be legal?
Correct. So all the legal, you know, disarm within dwellings, all that was, those laws in place would apply. So for the fall turkey hunt, it'd be legal weapons, which is archery, crossbow, and the shotgun within those ranges.
We have some more questions down this way.
So 12 gauge is not legal?
It is legal.
It is legal.
What we're doing is allowing 28 gauge in addition. It used to stop at 20 gauge. We're now allowing 28, or recommending 28 gauge.
Why not a point system on your fall hunt?
The main reason is we didn't want bonus points to get carried over, and because we're trying to use this as a hunt to mostly address conflicts, and so it'll be kind of flexible each year. It's less predictable than the spring hunt, and so we thought it might work better this way, so people aren't accumulating a bunch of points that, you know, in a few years maybe there's less opportunity or more. It's not as consistent in the spring, but, you know, I guess we're open to suggestions.
So you'd have, if you did points, you'd have to have a fall point and a spring hunt, or spring point, something
yep,
like that.
Yep, that's kind of what we thought.
Seems like whatever you do a draw, eventually they end up having to have a point system.
And that may happen with this. You
always
know.
Got the lucky ones that draw every time and the unlucky ones that don't.
Yeah, and we would most likely recommend a preference point for the fall because it's more of a general season. But that's something we could look at.
Jason, I'm just curious, what are you hearing on, or have you heard enough to say anything on sage grouse counts for the year? I know on our West Desert units down here we were up. Do you have any general feel for the state?
In a general sense, I haven't got any of the data, but talking with our biologists, it seems like we're up. this year, maybe quite a bit. We'll see when the final numbers come in, which is very consistent with the cycle that sage grouse we see. They kind of go through this cyclic nature, and it's following that cycle very, very closely, actually. So I think we'll see an increase in the number of birds this year.
I just noticed that the 10% falconry, you're having those guys go for the draw. Were those tags even being used?
Yeah.
Or is that why you went to it? It's just so we could get the unused ones into the...
What we saw is very little utilization. We were only seeing about 30 people taking advantage of that. Again, it was pretty difficult in the time because we're using within year information. And so we were getting really crunched for time. And honestly, we thought it'd be fair to have those guys compete.
Oh yeah, I think it's fine. I just was wondering if it's a way to get more if there is opportunity left on the table, I'm all for it because it sounds like there was.
Okay. One question I had with the fall turkey hunt is 15% to the youth. Is that kind of a standard percentage?
Yeah, we use that for sage grouse, sharptail.
It just seems like. If we're taking females, it might be more geared to youth, but maybe not. I didn't know if
we'd
want a higher percentage, or maybe they'll be taken care of just with a normal draw or something. But it seems to me like it's kind of a youth hunt, but maybe not.
You know, I think we'll have a lot of adults that are interested in the fall hunt. The youth, we have 15% set aside, which is pretty standard, and that's why we recommended that number.
One more question I had. This came from a comment from some people down in St. George, but how have we always had an hour requirement? You know, like the turkey hunt starts at a certain time each day and ends at a certain time each day. Has that always been in place?
As far as I can remember,
it seems to me like you hunt turkeys when they hit the ground and. You hunt turkeys till they go back into the roost. Well, the story that I heard, I'll tell you the story, and you guys can take it for what it is. But, okay, the guy's out hunting with his 14-year-old boy, first time he's hunted turkeys. They're hunting on private property. The turkeys are there for a few minutes in the morning, and they're there for a few minutes in the afternoon because they're coming through. And they're all set up, they're calling, they got a real nice tom coming, and he gets there like 2 minutes after the closing time. And they don't shoot it. And I don't know. Is that hard to enforce? Are we hunting from turkey on the ground to turkey in the tree? It seems to me like turkey hunting's new to me. I love the hunt. It's a lot of fun, especially with the youth, with my kids. I hope my grandkids hunt. But it seems to me like you get an opportunity early, and you might get an opportunity late, and it's kind of hard to watch the clock.
Well, you know, the hunt times are standard that we have for the division. They're the same as deer and elk, that kind of thing. And the main reason for turkeys is we don't want to promote people shooting roosting turkey, shooting them out of the trees.
That's illegal at 12 o'clock noonday, though, right?
Wait, so, shooting a roosted tree turkey is illegal.
Yeah. That's what I'm.
That's what I'm saying. Shooting a turkey in a roost is illegal, correct?
Out of a tree, yep.
So it wouldn't matter if it's at noonday or if it's at 6:42 a.m. That's illegal. So, sorry.
Yeah, you know, again, it's new to me, but it just seems like once they come out of the tree, we ought to be able to hunt them, and tell her back in the tree, we ought to be able to hunt them.
The hunting hours are pretty standard. Most hunters are familiar with it. And actually, it's an advantage with turkeys because they're active during the day. They're not like deer or elk that can be nocturnal. So you actually have more opportunity for turkeys than even like big game because they're more active during daylight hours.
Okay, that was just a question. Do we have any other questions from the rat? Mike?
On this crow situation, Do other states actually consider a crow a game bird? It just baffles me that we're considering them a game bird, a migratory game bird.
Other states do, and when Blair goes into the details, I think he has some details on how many other states and that sort of thing.
Okay, we have one more question. Rusty?
Can you bait turkeys?
No.
No,
you may not.
Rusty, you can't spill a grain bag out on a gravel road for turkeys, okay?
He asked if you could for crows.
Oh, absolutely.
Do we have any other questions from the rack? Any other questions from the audience? Come forward and please state your name.
My name is Mike Clark. Question on the late hunt for the turkeys. Why would we let you put in for spring and fall when people don't draw in the spring, should have a better chance at equaling out and letting them draw in the fall as kind of a bonus chance at a hunt rather than give everybody in the state thrown in again and ruin their chances of drawing a turkey that year and giving other people a chance to draw too?
Thank you.
So in the spring hunt, anyone can hunt turkeys. You know, we have an over-the-counter season, unlimited permits. The limited entry, it is a little bit tougher to draw. But what we thought was everyone would have an equal opportunity in the fall to draw the permit, and anyone can hunt turkeys in the spring. So that was kind of our rationale for the recommendation.
Another question?
But that would still leave the limited entry is what I'm talking. They're both limited entry hunts, basically, because you're limiting the hunt for the fall to these areas and so many permits, and you're limiting the limited entry for the early hunt, which is more productive and things, and then you go to the general hunt, and you're just kind of up in the air whether you're going to be successful or not. These would be basically more of a, you know, a guaranteed good hunt like a limited entry hunt is on the turkey in the normal season.
Do we have any other questions from the public? Please state your name, Jake.
Jake Albrick. What's the hunter success rate on sage hens last year, last couple of years?
Varies on the four different hunt areas. But it usually ranges from about 60 to 80%, depending on the year and the unit. And that's number of hunters that harvest at least one bird, which is what we consider successful. They can harvest two. We track at least how many harvested one bird.
Come forward.
Scott Christensen, just representing myself. I just wanted to make a comment on the upland game and mostly just thank the division for the birds that they put together last year on everything and gave sportsmen the opportunity to raise. We took advantage of that over in Wayne County. A friend of mine and I, Kevin knew, we raised about 200 birds, let them go down at the Bickham Bottoms, which is a WMA of the state. Just had a lot of fun. I was really excited to see the change date. My only complaint about it was we were cramming and trying to kill with only two birds a day. We raised way more than we could give away. It seemed like we had probably 30 youth at different times trying to come down, and we were planting birds and letting them shoot them, and we had just a great time. And I think there was a lot of people that didn't realize that that was going on that had some phenomenal hunting. Between what I was able to do and SFW was able to do, I think we let go about 400 roosters on a pretty small area. And we invite you guys that said they're on private, come over to Wayne County. We got a lot of birds. We're going to do it again this year. I think the SFW is going to fund the birds. But I'm really excited to see the extended time on those areas. We could definitely use it, give more opportunity to hunt upland game. So I just want to thank the division for that. It's been a great program.
Is that your comment that you had there, Scott? We appreciate your comment. We need to train you a little bit in the meeting procedure, so when you go up to the Wildlife Board meeting, then that we do questions, and then we do comments off the cards. But so when you get up in front of Jake, he'll keep you in line. But no, we do appreciate your comments and you being here. Thank you very much. If there's no further questions from the public, then we'll go to the comment section now, and we have cards from Paul, Niemeyer, and then DeLoss. So, Paul, if you want to come, and then DeLoss next.
I'm representing Sports and Fish and Wildlife. We concur with everything that was just presented, with one exception. We would like the youth hunt between the spring draw and the general season spring to be 5 days instead of three. Give you a little more chance if you're one of those kids, because that's kind of what most of what we're doing around here anymore is, trying to get this opportunity going for kids. So we just asked for 5 days instead of three between those two hunts.
So let me ask you, Paul, then, do you have to shorten one of the hunts, or how would you propose that be done? Because you have the limited entry, and that usually ends on a Thursday, and then you'd have 5 days before you start the general season. Is that what you'd be? So the general right. season would start in the middle.
We don't necessarily want to shorten that second hunt, but just move it back two more days. Okay. And you could add 2 days on the end.
So you'd have to change the date and extend it that way.
Yeah.
Okay.
DeLoss Christensen, Glenwood, Utah. Just representing myself, I'd like to support the division's recommendation. Particularly appreciate the extended pheasant hunt for the state lands. Give these youth and these upland game hunters a little more time to shoot some of these birds that we're raising for that purpose. So really appreciate that. And I have a question that may be out of place in the process, but the question I've got is whether or not crows are known to bother sage grouse eggs. Is that a reality or just a rumor that takes place?
One thing to keep clear is ravens are different than crows. And so there's good research documenting that ravens can have impacts to sage grouse nests. Not as good of information about crows. Often crows live in a little bit different habitat than sage grouse. But if they were to overlap, you know, crows are intelligent just like ravens are. They might be able to take advantage. But I think the issue is probably more of a raven issue than a crow issue.
My comment would be then, with regards to the many concerns for agriculture and use of public lands for livestock grazing and hunting, of course, that we give some serious thought, if not today, soon, into harvesting these ravens then, if they're putting our lands at jeopardy. We need to take care of that, and it needs to be put on the agenda. Thanks.
Thank you, DeLoss. That's all the comment cards. That's all that we have. Do I have any comments from the rack? Okay, Bill.
So on the youth hunt, why is it just 3 days? Would it be a problem to have a three-day youth hunt and then have that permit continue on through the remainder of the general season along with the other hunters? Can you extend that youth permit to the exclusive 3-day hunt and then hunt along with the regular hunt afterward?
You're talking turkeys?
Yeah.
So what we would do, as mentioned, is we have the hunts running pretty much continuous, and so we would either have to shift the limited entry hunt forward and add the days there, or cut into the over-the-counter season and shorten the hunt there. We don't generally want to go into June with the turkey hunt because you start to have poults, chicks on the ground, and we don't want to impact that. Oh, Kevin has
it. I think you misunderstood the question, Jason. I think, Dale, so right now, if a youth buys an over-the-counter tag, they can hunt those 3 days, but then they can continue to hunt clear through the end of May right now.
They can
continue. They can already do that. So the question would be, do we make that 3-day hunt a 5-day hunt, and then still, I think them being able to hunt through the end of May is always been on the table. That's the way we do it now, and I would suspect we would continue to do it that way.
Correct. Sorry, I misunderstood. Yeah.
I was just under the impression they could only hunt 3 days and their hunt ended.
So what it amounts to is their over-the-counter hunt starts 3 days before everybody else's does right now. Yeah.
I have just a logistical question. What if, and I'm just asking, we've got laws in the books that are hard to enforce, but say with turkeys, what if you hunt them from when they hit the ground to when they hit the roost? Do you see a problem with that, with taking the times out of it and going with a common sense approach with that? Or do you see, just answer that.
Well, sometimes. And we've all been there. Common sense and hunting don't go together at times. You know, there's a strong drive there, and having some limits on it is sometimes good. It's, you know, Cody, you know, it's really an enforcement issue as much as anything. Do you have anything you'd like to respond to that from a, you know, right now it's a half an hour before official sunrise and a half an hour after official sunset, and that's pretty standard for everything. You know, for the case of simplicity, I think it makes a lot of sense to keep it the same, just so that it doesn't matter what you're hunting, it's the same. So,
from a law enforcement standpoint, you know, the last 6 years that I've been doing this job, one of the common complaints I get is people shooting them out of a roost, but it's really tough to catch. We do occasionally catch them shooting it out of a roost. To be honest, the hours thing, I've never had a lot of problems with that. I had one call last year. An individual called and stated, "Hey, they just shot this out of a roost they shot before shooting hours, but it actually turned out they shot." Usually, if you look at those shooting hours, we're allowing you to shoot pretty much from the point you can see the bird until you can't see. It's pretty dark when you can shoot, and it's pretty dark when you can't shoot. My concern would be, especially with the spring hunt, is are they going to be able to see the beard? Are they going to know they're shooting a rooster versus a hen? If it's that dark, are they going to know what they're shooting? So, that from a law enforcement standpoint, that would be my concern. I don't want to waste my time pinching. My goal is not to be out there harassing good and to be harassing good people that make simple mistakes. So the cleaner we can keep it from a law enforcement standpoint, the better it is for us.
I can appreciate that.
So we can focus on the bad guys. I mean, that's...
Thanks, Cody. Hey, Eric, next one's yours.
Any additional comments from the rack?
I tend to agree with Mr. Clark on the draw, the point system. I think if you're going to do a point system, or they should be the same and provide opportunity or fairness. If someone draws, then they're out, and then you have a new batch that puts in for the fall hunt. Provides opportunity for more people through the draw system. So. I'd like some discussion on that to have the point system the same.
The one downside to that is, and I'm just sitting here thinking about it, is there may not be an opportunity every year, so these guys might be acquiring points because that's what we do as hunters. We just, oh, a point, we'll buy it. And it may not even be something that they use very often, and with points comes entitlements sometimes.
Right, but it would be good. They would be the same point. If you had a fall point, it would be
Oh, you're saying combine the fall, the both hunts.
It would be a turkey point. So if you didn't draw on the spring hunt, you could apply for the fall hunt, and you'd have a better chance of drawing in a fall hunt than someone that had already drawn.
I think you're going to run into a lot of people who wouldn't want to smoke their spring points on a fall bird.
Well, that's okay. There's very few permits. There's only 200-300 permits, so it wouldn't be a big.
Well, no, but if you put in, I mean, I like the idea of keeping them separate all the way around because it is two very separate hunts. I mean, if it's
a turkey.
I understand that they're two separate hunts, but they're both would be, like you say, people would want to burn their points on the fall hunt, and a guy puts in and burns his point on the spring hunt, and he draws it, and then he says, God, I can put in for a fall hunt anytime because I don't need to, and we're all going to put in for that. The guy that didn't draw the spring hunt gets aced again by the guy that already drew the spring hunt and draw a fall permit, which, you know, if you draw a spring turkey, you're out for the fall. And that makes you do a little bit of, you know, everything isn't free in this world. You got to make a decision, you know. Do you want to hunt spring or fall or take your chances?
Any additional comments or discussion in regard to that? That can be addressed as a separate item. It could be addressed as an amendment, or it could fail from a motion. So you guys can, Claire, you ready?
I move that we accept the division's recommendations on the turkey proclamation as presented.
Do we have a second? Okay, we have a motion to accept the recommendations as presented and a second by Brian. Do we have any discussion on the motion? Mike?
Yeah. Is this time to make an amendment?
Yes.
I'd like to make an amendment to the motion that the fall turkey hunt is a limited entry hunt, that we lump it in with all the limited entry hunts. It's just a different time. It's the same species. It should just be limited entry fall turkey hunt, southern region, or limited entry fall turkey hunt, northern region, if those are the two areas. So it just basically adds two more limited entry hunts. Is that right?
Same point system.
Yeah, same point system. Basically the same thing.
Okay, we have an amendment to the motion. Do we have a second on the amendment? And we have a second by Rusty. Do we have any discussion on the amendment?
I have a question. On this map of the northern region, are those primarily private property areas that we're talking about here? Or, I mean, we're problem birds.
Depends on the hunt area. So some of the southern region proposed hunts have quite a bit of public land. The northern region has quite a I didn't do an analysis on the percentage of private, but a lot of it is private in the northern region. But I think it varies by the region and the hunt unit.
And you guys would obviously put your little notation in there. Once it reaches a certain percentage, you guys usually put a notation. Sorry, a notation in there saying this is a primarily private hunt, so these guys know what they're getting into when they put in for it?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
Any additional comments, Rusty? We need to... have any other discussion on the amendment? Okay, we have an amendment and a second to the amendment that the fall turkey hunt be included in the limited entry point system. We're ready to vote. All those in favor of the amendment? Those opposed? The amendment fails. 5-4. Claire?
Dave, I need to restate my motion to include also the upland game portion. I just mentioned it, the turkey. Turkey and upland game in my motion.
Okay, that's the main motion.
The main motion.
And who had the second?
I just mentioned turkey. I need to add the upland game also in that.
All right. Rusty?
I'd like to make an amendment to the motion. I'd like to make an amendment to the motion to increase the youth to the 5 days rather than the 3 days on the turkey hunt.
Okay. Do we have a second? We have a second from Lane. Have any discussion on this amendment?
I just want to be clear. Would you be taking from the back end of that 2 more days then? Or would you be taking from the front half of the limited entry to make that a 5 day?
I think the easiest way to do that, Brian, would be just to the limited entry leaves the limited entry because those dates are already set, and then not start the over-the-counter hunt until Wednesday.
For 2 more days.
That's the simplest common sense solution to that. That's how I would look at it.
End at the same time.
Yeah, and still end on May 31st.
I was going to say that.
Yeah.
That's what you're mad, isn't it?
Okay. Do we have any further discussion on the amendment, Claire?
We do realize that Monday and Tuesday these kids are in school. Are we encouraging a little truancy here?
Well, we have a half an hour before sunrise and a half an hour after sunset.
This is true.
Okay, are we ready to... excuse me.
The proposal that you just had, doesn't that shorten the regular over-the-counter season 2 days?
Yes.
For everybody
else? That's their
yes. So
we need a vote on that amendment.
Okay, we're ready to vote on that amendment. All those in favor? Those opposed? Motion, the amendment carries. Now, that was, what was the count on that?
7 to 2.
Now we're ready to vote on the main
amended motion.
Amended motion to accept the plan as presented with the amendment
for turkey and upland game.
All those in favor? Unanimous? Motion carries. Okay, now we're on. Which one? 8? Use of game birds rule amendment.
I told you you're going to hear from me for a while. This one's short, hopefully. So this is a rule 46, the use of game birds in dog field trials and dog training. So we're proposing a 5-year extension with a couple of clarification. Correction for language of species again. We mentioned blue grouse, which are now called dusky grouse, and Hungarian partridge, which are now, they're called gray partridge. So just correcting a few of the species names in that rule, as well as clarification and consistency with the use of dogs on WMA. So what we would like to do is have the upland game, turkey, waterfowl, and this rule all say the same thing about using dogs on WMAs. That's all I had for that one. Very short. Thanks. The exact wording is in your pamphlet in both the upland and turkey rules. What we basically say is, in general, dogs can be used on WMAs with some exceptions during the spring on certain WMAs where we're trying to grow either upland game or waterfowl, so nesting and brood-rearing periods. For those important WMAs, we would like to have those closed to dog training during those critical times.
Thank you. Do we have any questions, further questions from the RAC? Do we have any questions from the public? Do we have any comment cards on this item? Do we have any comments from the RAC? We're ready to entertain a motion. Lane?
I'd like to make a motion that we accept Rule R657-46, use of game birds, as presented by the division.
Do we have a second? Second by Dale. Okay, so we have a motion and a second to accept the new rule R657-68 as presented. All those in favor? Motion carries unanimous. We're on waterfowl.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tonight I'll be presenting the migratory game bird recommendations for 2014-2015 season. So I wanted to first just give a brief overview of some of the reasons why we had moved the waterfowl recommendation process up. In the past, we've done it in the July rack, but the main reason is because the Fish and Wildlife Service is changing their regulation process. Currently, the way that we run that is we go to our summer meeting, which is typically in July. We get our harvest information, our population information, our habitat information at those meetings, and then we formulate our recommendations there. They go on to the Service Recommendation Committee and eventually get published in the Federal Register. And at that point is when we have the official frameworks that we can operate under for our waterfowl season. And so what the feds are currently under is a pretty tight time constraint from the time in that SRC meeting, which is in August, until the time when our waterfowl hunts start in the end of September. And so they want to move that process back to the month of March, which allow them additional time to publish things in the Federal Register, which in turn means that we can move our process back for several different reasons. What it'll allow us to do is to have additional time for our guidebook process. Currently, we're running through it relatively quickly, typically start it in August and have it finished before the waterfowl hunt. We also can sync these up with our up and game recommendations, so we can do all of our bird hunts at one time, so it really makes things a little better for us. The one caveat there is that we currently don't have any of our updated population or habitat information that's being collected right now, and so we won't have that until the feds move their process, which will probably be 2016. And so at this point we don't have a lot of the season frameworks yet, but we do have the caveat that what we would go with is the most liberal option that we provided to us, so the longest bag limits and biggest, longest seasons. So some of the information we do have, this is just a graph or a map right here kind of showing precipitation levels this winter and what we can expect for this coming fall flight. For the most part, our waterfowl production areas occur just on the Canada-U.S. border in the Prairie Powell region, and for the most part they've had averaged, even above averaged, snow and rain fall this last fall and winter. And so for the most part, we should have another great fall flight. We have had some areas that are warmer and drier than they have been in the past, but most of these areas aren't really high waterfowl production areas. As far as our North American breeding duck populations go, last year was our second highest fall or spring count ever. So with the number of birds that we had in last year's fall flight, we should have a pretty good fall flight again this year. Our Canada geese populations continue to do really well here in the Rocky Mountain region. They've been steadily increasing really since about the 70s, and so we don't really have any concerns with our Canada goose populations. And tundra swan populations, kind of the same thing. Seen them increasing steadily since the 60s, so for the most part an increasing trend and a really robust swan population as well. So the way our recommendation processes go, our duck hunts are established primarily on our mallard population. Whatever the mallard population is doing is what package we will get. So we have several different options that are allowed to us based on that mallard population, and I would expect that this year we'll have the most liberal package offered to us again, which is a 107-day season and a bag of seven. There are several different species, though, that do have species-specific harvest strategies, and those are pintail, canvasback, and scop. Those are kind of up in the air on what package we'll get until those breeding bird surveys occur this spring. But for the most part, I would assume that we'll have another maximum season for pintail, which is 107 days and a bag of two. Canvasbacks will likely be another 107-day season and probably a bag of one or two, depending on what that population is doing. Last year, our SCOP package was 86 days and a bag of three, and that'll likely be that as well. But there is some fluctuation there. Once those counts are done, we'll know for sure what we'll have. And so as far as season dates for these and bag limits, we'll have our general waterfowl hunt occur this year on October 4th and run until January 17th. That's typically what we do every year. And the SCOP season, should it be an 86-day season or any of the other species, it would begin on October 4th and run until December 27th. For the bag limits, those will be similar to what they were last year with the max for canvasback, scop, and pintail. And then the other bag limits and possession limits are the same from last year. For the goose hunts, we do have several changes to our zones. For the dark goose zone, we're going to be for the northern goose zone, we're going to be including Locomotive Springs, which is on the far east side of that northern boundary. That's that gray-colored polygon there. And so it really only takes in a couple more acres. It really shouldn't impact anything. It just makes it easier for us to define that boundary. The urban zone, we're also making a small change there. In the past, we had defined it specifically as the county boundaries, and we've adjusted those a little bit to follow along some of the major interstates and roadways just to make those boundaries more identifiable. And then we have removed Washington County from that urban zone. There really wasn't a whole lot of participation there, and for the most part, those geese weren't coming out and being any more likely to be harvested than they were at other time periods of the year. So that was the additional change. The other change for dark geese is we're increasing the bag limit this year to 4, which would be a possession limit of 12. For light geese, this is the same as last year, similar season dates, similar bag and possession. For swans, it'd be similar season dates as well. We can go to the second Sunday in December, and so that season will end on the 14th of December. It would be the same area and the same number of permits as last year. Youth Day will be on September 20th. And then one additional change we're making this year, we're making a statewide shooting times that are occurring from a half hour before sunset till official sunrise. So this will result in the no delay for the opening of the waterfowl season, which we have done in the past in some of the counties along the Wasatch Front. We've had a lot of concerns with people that have been shooting early, so a lot of violations that way, and a lot of confusion. And so for the most part, this should sync everything up around the state and make everything more consistent. So moving on from the waterfowl to some of the migratory upland bird species. For the doves, this year we have the option of extending our season for 30 more days. So we would be proposing to have the season from September 1st to October 30th. And we would also be recommending increasing the bag from 10 to 15 this year, which would give it about a possession limit of 45. So should allow more opportunity for hunters, particularly down here in the southern part of the state, where they'd be able to hunt through the month of October. And we're also recommending having some of our waterfowl management areas open to dove hunting as well, just to provide more opportunity to other people throughout the part of the state, and particularly down here in the southern part. The only caveat with that being that Clear Lake, we would recommend that it only be open until September 15th just to accommodate waterfowl hunters, give a little bit of a break there so that people can have a more quality waterfowl hunting experience. For band-tailed pigeons, this will be the same as last year, same season date, same bag, and just the recommendation that people still have to get the free band-tailed pigeon permit that they have in the past. For sandhill cranes, we are not recommending any changes here either. Still the same season areas, dates, and possession limits. The permits for this are allocated through the filing process, and so we just ask for the same thing as the cranes and grouse that the board and RACs just approve that process as they have in the past as well. So lastly, probably the most controversial topic, the crow hunts you guys had a lot of questions with. I want to go through and just give a little bit of background information on the crow populations here in Utah and some of the reasons for this hunt. Hopefully it'll clear up some of the questions that everybody may have. So for the most part, the populations of crow that we have in Utah really didn't show up until about the early 1990s. This is what you're looking at here is our breeding bird survey data. And so the number you see on the left-hand side of this graph is just an index of the population, so we don't have an actual estimate of population of crows in the state, but we do have a very healthy population. We can see since really about 1990, we've seen an increase in that population on our breeding bird surveys. And so, crows are relatively new here, but we do have quite a few of them now in the state. As far as where crows are hunted in the United States, we have 45 of the 50 states currently have crow hunts. The only Exceptions to those would be in Montana, Utah, New Mexico, Texas, and Hawaii. Crow hunting is really nothing that, you know, we're not really inventing the wheel here. It's something that's done pretty much all across the country, and people have enjoyed it for quite a while now and really hasn't seen a huge detriment to the crow population. Some of the reasons why we're recommending this hunt, we've seen some damage from some of our grain crops and corn. They'll eat corn seeds as they're emerging from the ground, as well as pick of the stalks. And we have seen some documented cases of them taking grain, as well as some nut and fruit crop problems in that category. They have also been documented to affect young livestock, so they're similar to ravens, where they'll pick at their eyes of young calves and sheep. And they are fairly efficient nest predators. As Jason alluded to, we probably don't have a lot of problems with them here in Utah as far as sage-grouse go, but they have been documented to have impacts on upland and waterfowl birds and any other nesting birds. And the roosts really become a nuisance problem. They create a lot of noise. In the winter, we get large roosting colonies, and so we have several hundred birds in one area, so it's a lot of noise, a lot of droppings, and a lot of tree damage as well. And they also have been known to transmit several diseases. TGE is a digestive tract disease that has occurred in swines. It's come from crows. Also, avian cholera, as well as histoplasmosis, which is a respiratory disease that's been known to come from spores in their fecal matter that affects humans. And then lastly, just to show you how many species of birds we actually hunt in Utah, this isn't an all-out division declaring war on every bird species in Utah. For the most part, we really hunt just a small percentage of the number of birds that are occurring here in Utah, and only about 32 species of the total 400-plus species of birds that are here in Utah. So what we'd be recommending for our season dates would be September 1st to the 30th. That would cover the period of when we're having damage to a lot of our fruit crops, as well as to coincide with the dove hunt, so there'd be hunters out in the field already pursuing a similar species. And then we'd have the hunt close for a time and then occur again on December 1st through February 28th. This is when we get a lot of migratory crows coming in, too, and we have the big roost colony. So we address some of the concerns we have with the roosting behavior. It'd be a statewide hunt and have a bag limit of 10 birds and possession of 30. We're recommending this falls under the migratory upland game bird species, so it'd be similar to what we do for doves, cranes, fan-tailed pigeons, so all those rules would apply, the shotguns with plug, shooting hours, etc. We're recommending that it falls within that category because it would be considered a game species now. Currently, it's not hunted in the state, so it's considered a non-game species, but that's kind of how we define our birds, as if we hunt them or not, so we'd be considering an upland game bird species. We would require people to have a valid hunting license if they were to participate in a crow hunt. They would also have to remove the birds from the field, similar to what they would with any other game species, because they would be considered a game species. And so lastly, just a few of these rule changes, modifying our weapons of take, allowing crossbows, which we've been trying to make consistent with all of our hunted species, as well as some clarification and consistency on the use of dogs. Also, this additional modification to our collection, importation, transportation, and possession of animals. This additional change would allow crows to also be taken outside this hunting season through a declaration order that's covered by the Fish and Wildlife Service. So currently it is illegal to take crows in any form or fashion, whether hunting or whether they're occurring or participating in depredation acts. So this would allow people to kill them when they were doing things they're not supposed to, and it wouldn't require people to have a permit. But they would have to report to the Fish and Wildlife Service if they were to take any crows under this new rule. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the rack? I have a question. I don't know that I can tell the difference between a crow and a raven.
Okay.
Is that going to be an issue?
Yeah, it's, well, the way the other states have addressed it around us, they've put out literature to kind of explain the differences. For the most part, there's a large size difference. There's also behavioral differences. Typically, ravens are more solitary. Crows will tend to be in larger groups. And so there are quite a few ways to determine or distinguish the differences, and so that is something that we would, you know, put out a lot of information about to try to educate our hunters before they actually go out and participate in the hunt.
Matt.
What about hunting sandhill cranes in the southern region?
Yeah, so that's it was an action item, I believe, last year, possibly the year before that, and 2 years ago, yeah. And so we looked at that. Kind of the constraints we're under now is we only get a certain number of cranes that we can harvest each year. And for the most part, we've been putting all of our resources towards areas that have high numbers of cranes and high numbers amount of depredation. And so, for instance, up in the northern region, they tend to have about a third of the total number of cranes in the state and lots of damage up there. And so if we were to create a hunt down here, we'd have to pull permits from some of those other regions that have a lot of depredation. And so what we are currently doing is doing a yearly crane survey to track the number of cranes as well as trying to assess any damage that we may have. And so at some future point, should we get more allocation of sandhill crane tags, this would definitely be the first place we would look at doing a hunt.
Can you apply for more permits from the flyway, or are they just not set in stone?
Hey, it's based off of a 3-year average of the total crane population in the Pacific Flyway. And so based on whatever the crane population is doing, we get a certain percentage of that. It usually comes out to be about 9 or 10% of the total permits that are given out that year. And so that's based off of the breeding and winter habitat that we have. And so there's not a lot of flexibility in that, just depending upon what the population is doing, and that'll raise and lower depending on the overall crane population.
What about those cranes that stay?
So we have a few cranes that are migratory, and for the most part they aren't causing a lot of damage other than the time periods when we have the majority of the cranes in the state. And so they still fall into the category as a migratory bird species, and so they fall under all the other rules that apply to all the other sandhill cranes that do leave.
We have a bunch of big bottoms that stay there year-round.
Yeah.
Raise their youngs in the alfalfa field.
Yeah, so we do have some cranes that do breed here as well.
Another question on crows. I can see where most of the upland game and the migratory birds, people kill them and eat them. Do they eat crows?
Yeah, there's actually quite a few recipes online where you can look up eating, how to eat crows. And so they would be considered a game species, and all those caveats would apply to them.
And I don't know if crows are a nuisance or not, but in my limited area, I don't see much of a nuisance in crows. I consider those doe deer in my field a nuisance more than I do crows, I can tell you that.
So we do, I mean, it's the nuisance and depredation damage is primarily along the Wasatch Front. That's by far where the most crows are. And we have had seen expanding crow populations. I know there's some in Cedar City, some in the Uinta Basin. And so there are species that probably will pioneer some new areas over time, but they are primarily concentrated in urban areas, so the chances of a large crow population occurring in southern Utah probably isn't a huge threat, I would think.
Go for it. Excuse me, I turned that off.
I have a question.
Sean first, and then Cordell.
I was wondering, Blair, will those be available with falconers as well?
Yeah, they would be. So any of the things that fall underneath the upland game bird rule for doves and pigeons would apply to.
No. Corda?
Yeah. My question is, we do have a state law now that says we cannot hunt crows.
Yep. Yeah. So
how did that happen when 45 other states hunt them?
It's each state has the right to pretty much kind of pick and choose which regulations they want to include in their rule, and so several years ago we took crows out. And I couldn't give you the specific reason why they were removed from that depredation rule, but we would like at this time to put them back into that depredation rule.
So does this have to be a legislative thing?
It's not. It's just modifying our rules that like we do each year. And so we would just be including crows with another list of birds that's already in there, such as magpies and starlings and things like that.
Well, why don't we just take them off the list and not make them a game bird and hunt them?
I mean, we're free to do both. And putting them on this list could apply to depredation still, even if the hunt doesn't go through. And so if we have the hunt go through, you would be limited to these specific season dates that we are recommending, whereas the depredation order that would go into effect would allow you to take them 365 days a year and remove you from having to have a license and things like that. So they're actually two separate things. We're just looking to include them both at this time because they're not on either one currently.
But it looks to me like that if we just take them off this list, whatever they're on, and you can shoot them any time you want, like Eurasian does, why do we need to make a special hunt for crows?
And that's where it becomes a little problematic, because they are allowed to be taken from the fish and wildlife standpoint, but from the state standpoint, they have to be listed as a species that isn't protected under all the other stuff in the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And so by putting them on this list, we would allow them to have additional privileges, which would be to kill them. Which currently they aren't on that list, and so we aren't allowed to kill them. They're considered like a robin or any of the other birds that are protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and can't legally be taken.
Okay.
Just as clarification then, we either have a hunting season for them or we don't hunt them at all. We can't add them to the non-game species like a coyote or a jackrabbit, whether it's, you can hunt them at any time, anywhere.
Yeah, you could technically, if you put them on the depredation list, you could take them any time of the year. You would just have to validate that they are be taken for depredation reasons and depredation reasons only. You can't just consider them completely unprotected because they are protected from the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and so you. Like coyotes and skunks and things like that aren't a federally protected species, so we can basically do whatever we want with them. But there are still some caveats because they do fall under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And
so it's either a season or we don't hunt them at all.
Yeah.
Without being a depredation with all the nonsense. Okay.
On the dove, the morning dove, is there any way that we can expand the starting date into August to provide more opportunity to buy September 1, they're gone.
Yeah, so again, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, it becomes kind of the bad thing here. So the Migratory Bird Treaty Act says that no hunt for migratory birds can occur before September 1st. And so, you know, ideally...
I understand it's a federal, but you guys meet with these people once in a while. Can you... You know, Montana's probably got the same issue. Idaho, it'd be nice if they had a bracket that they kind of started and came down the state and was able to hunt them. Because it provided great opportunity for upland hunting if the season was right.
But. Right. And the Migratory Bird Treaty Act would be like trying to change, you know, a huge, huge thing. And there's likelihood of that happen is very, very unlikely. And it's really put in place to kind of protect migratory birds, because a lot of them will have their young up until August. And so by the time September 1st comes around, there are still a lot of species that can't even fly. I mean, a lot of the later nesting species like redheads and things like that won't even have their flight feathers developed yet.
So Rusty, just to clarify that, Blair meets with the flyway folks, but the Migratory Treaty Act would have to be a congressional issue. That would have to be done by Congress in Washington to change the act. It's not something that the flyway can address.
Yeah, and I mean, we can definitely petition them too, but the likelihood of it happening is probably not likely at all.
Back to the crows.
Okay.
Because you declare them a game species, you put a limit on them, you make us remove them from the field. Now, is the wanton waste of wildlife issue going to also apply? In other words, if you don't want to eat them, you better not shoot them. Right?
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
So it would apply then?
It would, yeah.
Okay. Then let's just depredate them all.
Seems like our youth seasons are never the same. 2 minutes ago, well, 20 minutes ago, we changed it to 17 before July 31st, and now it's in the waterfowl, it's 15 on September 20th.
Yeah.
Just wondering.
So our overall plan as a division was try to make everything consistent as a 17 or younger. The hurdle we came into was the Fish and Wildlife Service only allows us to have youth hunts for kids that are 15 or younger.
So that's a federally deal.
It is.
Okay,
yeah.
That's fine.
It's something that we're going to try to work on in the future, but currently, if we want to have a youth hunt, it does have to be 15 or younger.
Now, that's something that wouldn't take Congress. That would just be through your meetings. You'd say, hey, what about 17? Just kind of keep poking them.
Yeah, and we explored that option. What we can do is create a split in the waterfowl season, which that by that point, I mean, we could have youth hunts for any ages. I mean, you could have a Teresa Griffin hunt if you want. Everybody that name could hunt. So we, yeah. Yeah. But what we would have to do is move the season up to where it's only a week before the general opener, and that didn't fly very well last year, so we decided to keep it like this for the time being.
One last question, Dave. By a raise of hands, who's going to hold the first crow barbecue?
Okay, I have a question. They have to be shot with a shotgun. Can we change that to a rifle or shotgun?
So if you were hunting them, they would have to be taken with a shotgun. With the depredation scenario, they do also have to be taken. There are some other caveats there. I mean, they can be taken with bait and things like that, but there are some requirements for taking them that way.
We can't change that.
And
make a rifle legal.
You can't for sure during the hunting season, and I don't think we would probably recommend that for the depredation either, just because it would create something that was kind of inconsistent with how we do everything else. So,
well, if we're going to hunt these things and eat them, we'd like to be able to kill them, and the easiest way to do it is with a rifle, not a shotgun.
Okay, we're still in the question portion. Do we have any other questions from the rack? Okay, I have several comments that we'll get to the... Right. I was just going to say I have several comment cards, and we'll get to the comments. Right now, we just want questions from the public.
This is probably the most confused that I've ever been. I had some experience with this once, years ago, when there was two walleye. There was a walleye board of Big Game Control. And that's when this treaty first got through Mexico, but somehow we let these birds slide through on that. And that's why you can't mess these ravens, is that international treaty. But at any rate, I went to the Wildlife Board, and they even gave me a special permit to kill some magpies so we could test the blood on them. That's back when Warren Harwood was actually on the Wildlife Board. And I'd go shoot them, and I couldn't get blood out of them, but he knew how to do it. And we sent him in, and we got they carried titers for diseases that's fatal to turkeys. And then they were doing that experimental vegetable growing deal in Spear County. I gathered up a lot of vegetables and whatever and showed them what the magpies and stuff were doing to them. But at any rate, they made the motion, and it passed, that we could hunt them and just hunt them, not seasons or whatever. And I'm not sure where that ever changed, because in my years through the rack and the board, I don't remember anything ever changing on those crows. But at any rate, well, I'll go into comments, but and the other thing, why, if we're going to hunt them, would we put that gap in the middle? Can we only hunt them so many days? Because they don't come into here until usually after the 1st of October. So you're thinking we can only hunt them, like, on a federal regulation, only hunt them so many days a year?
Yeah, so what the Fish and Wildlife Service gives us as far as framework is they can only be hunted 124 days. And so we picked the 124 days where we were having the most problem with them, and that was when we were having fruit problems, as well as the roosting colonies, which is primarily in during the winter months. So I can't remember. You had a question before. I'm not familiar with exactly how the hunts were structured a while ago, but I do know that currently they have allowed us to take depredating birds through a depredation order for the Fish and Wildlife Service. And it's a whole list of birds. It's included on it is cowbirds and magpies and crows. And so that's probably changed in recent years. I couldn't give you the exact date. As well as I don't know what the earlier hunting frameworks were, but this is currently the ones we have to operate under. So,
oh, good. There you go. Good job, Scott. State your name. State your name.
My name's Scott Christensen from Lower Utah. I guess I'm still confused on we still do have two choices. If we set it as a depredation season, or not a season but an issue, how could that be structured versus a hunting season? Obviously, probably just on private lands and things like that, but how would that work?
So, currently there's two choices, but they can both be accepted. And so, to address a specific hunting scenario, if you wanted to go out and hunt birds for no other reason other than just to go hunt crows, you could do that anytime during the September hunts, as well as from December 1st to February 28th. If you wanted to go out and just hunt crows, say, in June, you wouldn't be able to do that. And so that's why we've created the depredation order, which would allow you to shoot them 365 days a year, but it would have to be specifically for depredation reasons. And so we're asking for approval both of the hunting season, so more for a sport hunting opportunity, as well as the depredation season, which would be for depredation purposes 365 days a year.
Okay, so with the depredation, what kind of process would that be? A division officer or somebody coming out, meeting with the landowner? Because that's the whole goal, isn't it? I mean, that, and then we're spending hundreds of thousands trying to get some pheasants back and things like that, but yet we're got our hands tied on the crows, I guess. But so we could, if the landowner says, hey, I've got a problem and stuff like that, then those hunts could go 365.
Yeah, so it's pretty easy for landowners. They don't have any kind of criteria like contact us first or anything like that. The only stipulation is that if you take any crows for depredation reasons, you do have to report back to the Fish and Wildlife Service as well as the conservation officers in DWR. And then there are a couple other stipulations. You have to, provide access to those authorized individuals if they want it and things like that. But it's relatively simple and definitely far less complicated than our depredation process for deer and things like that. So,
the Lost Christians in Glenwood, Utah. The map that you put up showed 45 states that are managed and regulated differently than the five states that were in white. Are any of those black states able to do these things? Hunt crows year-round with a rifle without reporting, without eating, and without caring for the crow?
Yeah, so each state does have some ability to define some of those things. Like, for instance, we chose to put under the migratory bird rule because we did want people to remove them from the field and for them to be considered a game species and be consumed and all that. There is some flexibility there, but we chose not to mess with that just because we didn't want it to be viewed as just people going out just to kill stuff. And we wanted them to be taken and to be utilized like any other game species. As far as the hunting, though, there are the about four criteria the Fish and Wildlife Service gives us. One of those is you can't shoot them from airplanes. You have to shoot them with shotguns. You can only hunt for 124 days. And I think there's one other one, but I can't remember what it is. So you have to abide by a certain criteria to have a crow hunting season. The bag limits can vary. The season dates can vary. The fourth one is you can't hunt them during their peak nesting time. And so as long as you're abiding by those four things, you can pretty much have the hunt whenever you'd like and shoot as many as you'd like. But they do have to be taken with shotguns. And did I address all the questions you had?
So there is no state that has made arrangements to shoot them with a centerfire or a cartridge rifle. Everything is shotgun, and that's by regulation?
Yep, that's correct. Okay. As well as the 124 days, they can't be any longer than that for official hunting season.
So no state has a 365-day depredation hunt for crows then?
The depredation hunt is different than the hunting season. So if you had a crow that was eating your apple crop in June, you could go out there and legally shoot it, mm-hmm. and it wouldn't be considered hunting. Mm-hmm. But if you're going out just to hunt them and you weren't doing it for depredation reasons, you'd have to abide by the 124-day hunting season.
I guess the question that I have, and I think it goes back to some of the RAC members' question, the screen that you put up that showed the issues with crows as far as the disease and the other damage that they do, to me justifies removing crows whenever, wherever that you can. Different than deer or other things that we regulate, or upland game birds. Do you believe that you're doing all that you can with this regulation to mitigate against the issues of the negative impact of crows? And can you do more?
I think with the criteria we're given, we're pretty much doing just about all we can do. And we've tried to structure the hunting season when we're having the most damage. And we've tried to, make this something that is palatable to the constituent group that doesn't like us hunting in general. And so we've tried to make it, for a specific purpose and reason rather than just, another reason to go out and shoot stuff. And so I think we've been able to satisfy, all the interest with the recommendation we presented.
Okay, do we have any more questions? One more.
Starlings are black. Can't you put them on the same basis as a starling?
So starlings is included on this list. They aren't covered under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and so they can be legally taken 365 days a year.
It sounds to me like with your illnesses and disease and everything, they're the same thing, just different size.
Yeah.
Can't you get them onto that list, or does this go?
They actually are currently on that list, so they are legal game.
The difference is the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which covers one and not the other.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
Okay, we're ready to move to the comment cards. The first comment card I have is from Mike Clark, and then following him will be Paul Niemeyer.
The one item I had was about the goose limits. The feds were allowing four, we were allowing three, but it looks like we've already addressed that problem and jumped that to four by what was on the screen. And the other problem we run into, especially during the waterfowl season and into the spring waterfowl hunt, is the need for written permission. You get a list of people's names, their phone numbers, they say it's okay to hunt and everything, and then we're told, no, you have to have a description of property. Some guys have 20 and 30 pieces of property. And you get 20 or 30 guys to hunt on all this property, you're going to be packing a damn book with you. It's ridiculous. And why can't We've always went out and just got their names, says, do you have permission to hunt on this on my property? And the guy signs it and puts his phone number there if he wants to. Why can't this be good enough rather than having to carry a map of the county with you and a description of every farmer's property?
Okay, Paul.
Okay, on the crow thing. I can't hardly remember what I had for lunch, but this, what it was, and this is how the Wildlife Board got by it before, maybe we can't now, but in the Federal Register, it talked about if they were depredating, about to depredate, causing damage to ornamental or shade trees, and congregating in numbers to become a nuisance. Well, a crow is either depredating or about to. I mean, that's just... So I get nervous about protecting them and putting them on a... I can see the methodology, but I hope we're not getting going down a road that's going to bite us. But, and I would leave this to Rusty as much as anybody, but the crows in this area do not get here in September. You don't hardly ever see them till October. Do you see them down there earlier than that? Now, I'm talking about... The not the Boone and Crockett crows, the regular crows. Do you see them early like that down there? We don't here. I don't think I've ever seen them before really the 1st of October. So I would recommend if we're going to, I'd rather not go that route, but if we do, I would recommend that you put the season straight in at least down here because I don't think they're here. Some of you guys may know more about that than I do, but I don't. In Paiute, Sevier, and Wayne, and where I travel around, I don't see them that early. So that would be a thought. We thank you for recommending the other goose. Not that we can kill them, but at least it's a thought. Thank you.
Okay, my last card is from DeLoss.
DeLoss Christensen, Glenwood, Utah. My recommendation is based on the nuisance and the health issues associated with birds like starlings and magpies and crows. And the division's already demonstrated with their chart that they recognize that that's a concern. And I believe that we ought to ask the division not to be quite so concerned about what might happen if they do the right thing. And the right thing is to try and find the most liberal, free, accessible way that we can shoot as many of these birds as we can. Whatever that is, whatever other state has developed a plan that they're dealing with these crows. The comment was made that there's an issue in northern Utah. There's an issue here. There's a lot of crows in our valley. In fact, I've had numerous people comment to me in the last 5 years how many more crows we're seeing, flocks of crows here. And we need to deal with this bird. And we need to deal. And I don't know that we're not already there with this recommendation. But if it's not the most liberal recommendation we can have, we need to make whatever that is. Thanks.
Do you have a card?
Go ahead and give your comment and have anyone ask.
Okay, Scott Christensen, Lower Utah. I appreciate you explaining a little bit more. I have a better understanding. It does appear that hands are tied on quite a few issues. The one thing that I saw that I would recommend is the obvious lifting a limit. I don't see any reason to limit if somebody's having a good day and they can shoot 11. Let's let them do it. I think that's pretty awesome. I've never seen anyone shoot one. I've heard they shoot them out the window. I've never seen it done, though. But, okay. That's...
But that would be my recommendation, as we don't have a limit on that. It seems like we can control that, and that would be my recommendation to the RAC. Thanks.
Thanks, Scott. Okay, we're ready for comments from the RAC. Lane, you're up.
I have a comment that's going to address Paul's question. It's very ironic that just 30 minutes before I came to this meeting, I was watching the Sportsman's Channel at home and Meat Eater was on. And he was hunting crows in Georgia. And they actually had a segment on there where they breasted those crows like we do mourning doves and filleted the meat off of them, and they marinated them and they dredged them and they put a wine sauce on them, and I don't know what all they did, but anyway, I think they drank the wine. But anyway, just so that everybody knows, they did eat them, and the one guy said that they tasted like veal, only were chewier. So they can be eaten, because I saw them do it.
What's going to happen if someone doesn't quite understand the shapes and faces of the birds and accidentally shoots a raven? What's the go to jail? Boy, you'd be big with the other cons, won't you? What are you here for? I killed a raven.
Claire, are you ready?
Yeah, I'm also going to address Paul's comment there. I've been pretty forceful with my boys that if we shoot something, we eat it. I don't imagine we'll be hunting a lot of crows, but maybe. Remember when we have an annual trip up on the Pine Valley Wilderness area where we either take our horses or backpack in. And I made my boys wait till they were 8 before I figured they were, you know, strong enough to make that trek. And I got him in there. Of course, I'm carrying a double pack. My younger son was 8. I decided to have a nap in the aspen cabin, and the boys wanted to go hunting. I said, okay, but if you shoot it, you eat it. A couple hours later, I wake up, and I go out in the fire, and the fire pit's going. There's my younger son, 8, sitting on a log with a little pile of bones. I said, what did you find to eat? He said, I just finished my chipmunk and my robin, Dad. It can be done.
Can I bring you my crows? I let my daughter shoot Morven crickets with a BB gun. I treat them suckers.
Larry, comments down this direction? Brian?
I'm just looking at these season dates and wondering if this RAC wouldn't want to entertain maybe a split season for the southern part of the state to maybe prolong that 30 days if they're not down here. I'm definitely not for, if we're going to hunt them, I think they need to be, I mean, obviously part of that migratory bird issue. Another issue I have is I'd like to see if we do start hunting them, are we going to do studies that, and this probably should have been in the question to you guys, I'd like to see data back that there are more grouse and less depredation on eggs and things like that if we are going to open this door and start hunting them. Just a thought there. But mostly wanted to discuss with the RAC about maybe a split season for the southern part of the state.
Claire? Yeah, we do have a precedent set in the other waterfowl where we have a later start down here, so I think that should be entertained.
Pull the dates up on the crow thing and put it on the screen, please, Blair.
And Rusty, I'm definitely open to input on when do you think these birds get here. I know you're probably not a...
I don't think I...
Yeah.
It seems like they're all here. I got one nested in our hay barn, and it seems like they're here. like they're pretty much deer right.
And I can comment a little bit to that. So we typically have two different groups of crows. We have a resident population, which is in Utah year-round, and we have birds that will migrate in. Typically, the birds that migrate in will show up about mid-October in the northern part of the state, so I assume it's probably similar down here in the southern part of the state, maybe a little bit later. And then typically they'll leave and go north probably about March or so time frame. And so primarily down here, you're probably dealing with more of a migratory crow species, crow group rather than the resident crow group. So I don't know if that helps you differentiate.
So you think, is there a local biologist that could chime in on that? I just wondered if we only get 124 days to play, maybe.
So Brian, looking at the dates that he has up there, if you wanted to do it split, you just, what would make sense would be to do November 1st through February 28th instead of having a break during the month of October and November.
I don't know. I'm open to. Yeah, that's what I was wondering if they don't get here.
I was just wondering if they get here later, but it seems like that maybe there's a reason to hunt them that first 30 days to hit some of that resident species. I don't know.
I'm still hung on the game bird part of it, right? You know? I don't know if that's where we want to put them. I don't think people are going to hunt them to put in the fridge or the freezer to eat later on.
The state controls the crow right now, you say, the law, the state law.
The Fish and Wildlife Service.
Okay. So if you put it on a migratory, it becomes a federal bird, correct?
It already is. So.
You just said that the state had the control over the hunt.
Yeah, so it currently falls into the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which makes it a species controlled by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But they do offer us some criteria if we want to have a hunting season, as well as criteria to have a depredation order for them. And so currently we don't have the hunting season or the depredation order, so they're currently illegal to kill in Utah anytime for any reason. And so we're creating the hunting season more to address a sport hunting opportunity, and then adding them to our depredation rule to allow them to be taken anytime for depredation purposes.
But they are a federal bird right now. They're not. The state has nothing to do with it.
Right. Yep.
Okay.
So it's similar to like waterfowl and geese. We don't technically have authority to manage them either, but we are given options to have hunting seasons for them.
Mr. Chairman,
I think we're ready to try to get a motion.
Chairman.
Yes, Blair.
I move that we accept the division's recommendation on the waterfowl and the migratory game birds as presented, with the exception of the season date to address the southern region. We started on November 1st and run it through the 124 days.
For crows,
yes.
Okay. We have a motion from Claire. Do we have a second? Brian seconds the motion. Do we have discussion on the motion? If there's no discussion, we'll move to a vote. All those in favor? We do have discussion. Go ahead, Cordell.
Okay, my question is we go ahead and we pass this motion and they become a game bird. Are they going to start putting a lot more restrictions on us for the depredation part? And, huh? Someone who said they're already a game bird? Oh, somebody out there did. Anyway. So my question is, if we make these a game bird, then the fish and game going to be a lot more strict on a person that shoots a crow that says that, evidently from what I hear, as far as the depredation goes, you can shoot any now gun time you want to, as long as you say it's carrying a disease or eating a apple, correct?
Just eating an apple. Don't go with the disease.
Out of a tree. Apple tree.
Right, yep.
Okay. So what about the disease factor? If I say in my mind, I know that these birds are carrying diseases, I know that they are eating sage hen eggs out there, so every time I see a crow, why is that not a depredation problem?
If you said they were on their way to eat your tomatoes in your garden as well, then you'd be fine.
The thing that I'm trying to get to here is I don't want to pass something that we're going to be stuck with that makes it a whole lot harder for us to shoot crows in the years to come once we set this precedent like, well, we think they're a game bird.
So, Cordell, I think you're confusing crows and ravens.
No, I'm not.
Well, because no. Currently you can't shoot crows even for depredation, current, right, as of right now. This would just barely open that up.
Only in this state, right?
Well, Utah.
Well, one of the five states.
In five states.
The other 45 states can shoot them.
Well, under either a hunting season or a depredation. And there's probably a mix of all across the board.
Right, and that's what I'm trying to get through here, is if we go ahead and we say we're going to pass this, and we do pass it, and we're going to hunt them, down the road, is there going to be more problem? Because right now with the depredation thing, I can understand that. You can cover every crow you shoot. Okay? Is that going to get more stringent on farmers or crop growers to where that we have to do a 72-hour thing to call fish and game before we can shoot a crow?
Currently, we're going with everything the Fish and Wildlife Service requires us to do, and that doesn't have anything to do with, you know, 72-hour notice or anything like that. If the Fish and Wildlife Service did require us to do that, then we would have to do that as part of our condition of having the ability to take crows. But if they don't require that of us, then I don't ever see us requiring that of anybody either.
Okay, I wish we had a little bit more information from these other states, what they do, before we pass this thing and say that we're going to have a crow hunting season.
I can tell you that most of them currently have a crow hunting season as well as a depredation order. It basically, by having a hunting season, it allows you to take them and not to justify them causing depredation. It also allows you to use decoys and things like that and actually show that you're out there just to get crows to come in and shoot them. If you don't have a hunting season, then you aren't allowed to use decoys because you would be trying to lure crows in and shoot them when the assumption would be that you're shooting them because they're coming already to that area to cause depredation issues.
Okay, here's one big issue. If you go hunting them and you shoot one, you have to legally take it home and eat it. If you kill it... No. If you take them depredation, you can just kill them, right?
Correct.
Oh, I think it's a no-brainer.
Hour and a half, no brainer. This licensing or having a season opens up where we can do a depredation. We can't do one without this first one. This just opens the door to take care of the problem birds.
You can't shoot crows right now, depredation wise?
No.
Yeah, so currently it's illegal to kill crows for any reason whatsoever. So this would allow... The depredation part would allow you to take them 365 days a year, and the hunting season would allow you to take them outside of depredation issues during those specific season dates.
So, but I think there is some confusion here, Lane. You could do just the depredation and not do a hunting season.
Right.
Or you could do just the hunting season and not do the depredation. They don't have to go together. The proposal from the division is to have both a hunting season and a depredation order, but those two aren't necessarily linked to each other. Correct, Claire or Blair?
Okay. So we have a motion on the table and a second to approve the recommendations from the DWR as presented, with the exception that we would have a split hunting season for the southern region for crows. No split. What?
It'd be a straight, starting November 1st and going for 124 days.
Okay. So the hunting season would start November 1st. Straight. Okay. And we have a second on that motion.
All in favor? Any opposed? 8-1, motion carries. So now we're on item number 10, Utah Trail Hunter Program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kirk Smith, I'm the Hunter Education Program Coordinator out of the Salt Lake office. What I'm here to present to the RAC Committee is the Trial Hunting Program Rule 68. What this presentation will cover is a brief background and highlights of the new program. One of the issues that we're looking at with wildlife resources and hunting population is the decline in hunters we have in the state. A study was done back in 2000 by Families Afield that shows a replacement ratio for every 100 hunters we're losing, Utah is only replacing with 59. So we're not replacing hunters very, very good, very fast. And this program here is to address that. A brief background, let's just set the stage up for this just real quick. We've all worked with people that hunt or don't hunt. You've worked with this individual for years that doesn't hunt. Assume you're a hunter and he's a non-hunter. And all of a sudden one day he gets interested. And you're going duck hunting or you're going turkey hunting tomorrow, and you say, hey, I'm going turkey hunting, do you want to go with me? Under our current regulations, he wouldn't be able to go. With this rule, he could get on board with the program, and he could go buy a turkey permit, as long as there's one available for him to purchase, and he could go hunting tomorrow with you. He could also take another individual with him, whether it be his wife, a child, another friend, so he could have a companion with you also. So I'll get into the meat of it here. Some of the stuff we've been looking at, we've been monitoring this program in other states. Currently there's 35 other states that offer this type of program, and they've been doing it for several years. So we've monitored their progress. We've monitored what they've been doing on incident rates as far as safety and retention rates and hunter recruitment rates of how this is a good retention and recruitment tool to get hunters involved. What it allows is a hunter to try hunting. Try before you buy. Go out and try with a supervised hunter before you go through a formal hunter education class. Make up your mind and then jump on board and take a class. It's very family friendly. A situation, I just was talking with a guy yesterday, and he shared a situation or an experience with him. His wife wants to try hunting, and he's been talking about it for a year with her. But she's got a young family. They've got a young family, a couple of kids, and she just hasn't had the time or taken the time to go through hunter education. And when I told him about this program, he said this would fit our need perfectly. So it also increases the participation in hunting and support for wildlife conservation. Here's a map that shows the 35 other states that are currently doing it. And you see we have some white states primarily in the west. Arizona is also implementing a trial hunting program, apprentice type program, even as we speak. Senate Bill 165, they created the law that allows a trial hunting program to exist. They set down some very basic regulations to the law, leaving it very open to the Wildlife Board to, through rule process, to establish the finer details to it. They established that a hunter minimum age has to be 12 before they can hunt. They would be able to apply for hunts when they're 11, but have to be 12 to hunt. They have to be supervised at all times by a licensed hunter that is 21 years of age or older. And it's also available to residents and non-residents equally. So what we're presenting in the rule is that this will be available to anyone born after December 31st, 1965. And by state law right now, anybody born prior to that is exempt from hunter education already. 11 years old, they could apply for a hunt. 12 years old, they could then start hunting. We would establish and develop a brief online questionnaire that would have some safety components to it to ensure that the safety is on their foremind before they go out into the field. At that time, they would receive a trial hunting authorization number, which would go in place of the hunter education number in our database, which would then authorize them to buy licenses and permits moving forward. The licenses and permits we're proposing would be all hunting licenses with the exclusion of multi-year licenses, combination license, also excluding the multi-year, and hunting permits excluding some big game permits. And I'll explain those, present those here in the next slide. We also are proposing that they may participate in the hunting mentor program, utilizing this trial hunting program as meeting the hunter education requirement for the mentoring program. The hunts that are being proposed to be excluded from this program are the big game permits allocated through a draw. Your premium limited entry, once in a lifetime, CWMUs, dedicated hunter, sportsman permits. This would also include conservation or convention permits, which would be the primitive limited entry, the limited entry, and the once in a lifetime. As a trial hunter, they'd have to be the appropriate age. They'd have to possess a current hunting license or combination license and the appropriate permit. This program only waives the hunter education portion. They would still have to purchase the licenses and permits as a regular hunter education graduate would. They would have to be supervised in the field at all times as defined in Rule 23, 20, and 20, regardless of their age. Regardless of the hunter's age, they would have to be supervised at all times under that rule. The term of the program is 3 years. So it's a 1 3-year term. After completing hunter education, if they say in the first year of their trial hunting program, within that first year they decide, I'll go ahead and jump on board and take hunter education, at that time they would become eligible to apply for all big game permits. So they're not locked into this 3-year term before they take hunter education. The return rates that we're seeing on this in other states that have a 3-year term, 50% of the trial hunters are taking hunter education within the first year. Even though they could do it 3 years, they're taking hunter education in the first year. The following year, 25% of the remaining are taking hunter education and continuing on. So that's why we're proposing a 3-year term rather than just a 1 year. It seems to be a better fit for that retention effort. Responsibilities of the supervising hunter: provide direct supervision and instruction on ethics, hunt safety, and regulations. The supervising hunter could supervise 2 trial hunters at a time in the field. The supervising hunter must also possess a valid Utah hunting or combination license, must be 21 years of age or older, and have written consent from the parent or guardian if they're taking a minor as a trial hunter. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the rack? Questions from the audience? Oh, hold on. Brian's got a question. You got to get him warmed up here.
Would the, and I might have just missed it and you explained it, so if you did, I apologize. Is the mentor filling anything out to acknowledging that he's taking on those responsibilities, or are we just putting that in the code and it's just his responsibility to research the rule?
The supervising hunter does not have to complete any form or anything saying that they're eligible or to be the supervising hunter. We're leaving that up to them.
I have a question. What's the incentive for including out-of-state? I mean, we limit the number of out-of-state people that can come on a lot of hunts. Are we trying to recruit more out-of-state hunters, or are we?
We're trying to increase our hunting population as a whole, whether they're non-resident or resident individuals. And where we see the non-resident come into play is if it's a family member that's coming in, say, Thanksgiving time, and wants to go pheasant hunting with the family the next day. And so we see it as an opportunity for family members or friends that would be coming in for something like that.
So we don't have a cap on the deer hunt or anything else? Okay. That answered my question. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Questions from the audience? Please state your name.
Mike Clark. Is this a one-time deal, or is, like, he does it one time, a three-year shot when he's 12, 5 years down the road, he comes back to town and says, oh, I want to go on a mentoring project again. Is it going to be documented so he can only do it one time, or can he come back and forth and do it numerous times?
It'll be set up in the database to where when he enrolls that there's a start date and we can track when his 3 years are up. So it is a one-time, essentially once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
One other question.
So this is along the line of Brian's. So they don't have to identify their mentor?
No, they do not have to identify their supervising hunter.
So how do you know that they have one?
We leave that up to their responsibility to ensure that they follow the rules and regulations.
Yeah.
Cordell?
Yeah, well, what about the liability factor of this person that's taken him out without no hunter safety education and whatever, whether they shoot somebody, accidentally shoot somebody, and the kid's 12 years old and his parents turn around and I understand, I know what you're going to say, well, that's up to the person that's taken him out. He's responsible for that. But I think we need to take a long, hard look at that, taking kids out that's never touched a gun, and you're putting somebody in charge of them to take them hunting, and then an accident occurs, you know, I mean, that could even come back to you people on a state level because you're enacting this law that says they can go hunt. So I think something we really need to take a long look at, and I mean, I'm all for kids hunting, don't get me wrong, but I think that, and especially if you don't have to identify who's taking them out.
In doing the research on this and looking what other states are doing, the incident report and the safety rate is one thing that is very critical to this program. And looking at the records, looking at the statistics of other states, a hunter that participates in this program is four times safer than a hunter that has been through through hunter education and is not enrolled in this program. The numbers are 50 hunters per 1 million that were involved in an incident that have been through hunter education. With a trial hunter, it's 11 as compared to 50. So statistically, they're safer hunters because they are under that direct supervision. And this program is geared more towards the adult hunter, capturing that opportunity and that interest of that adult hunter that has, say, gotten through college and now is established to where he would have time and interest to do it. That's where we're focusing our efforts is with the more adult hunter.
Okay, you still have questions from the audience?
Mike Clark, when you say direct supervision, is there going to be a distance that they have to be from their mentor hunter or whatever, or are you going to let them run amok and just turn them loose and say, well, I'm with so-and-so and he's two ridges over from me? Or is it going to be a distance, you know, that they've got to be within, you know, sight, verbal commands, whatever?
Yes, there's already an established supervision rule that has that distance that they have to be within and verbal communication. They would have to follow that same distance and that same rule that's already established. For right now, it's primarily used in youth hunting, but this one would cross over to all hunters. All trial hunters would have to abide by it.
Do we have any comment cards on this one? Do you have comments from the rack? Claire?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if Kirk's going to get fired or just retire. He just sounds like you don't need it. We don't need hunter education anymore. If it's four times safer not to take hunter education, what are we doing? I'm not buying it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I have a comment too. I guess if we're targeting an older group, then let's just target them and not devalue the value of hunter education. I don't, you know, for 3 years we can have youth out there without going through the program. And my kids have gone through that. We've demanded they've gone through that. We have them start early. If they're going to handle guns, go through that process. I don't think we should take away from that. And if we want to value or try to get more adults, and let's set up a program for adults. And if 75% of them are going to come back in after 2 years, then let's have a 2-year program instead of a 3-year program. That's just some of my comments.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. The youth shouldn't be involved in this, no way. One time, one accident, one person dead is not worth it. I like Dave's suggestion, if we do it, or if it's done, adults only, 21 plus.
It is in state code that the age is 12. So
the state code is that it's the minimum of 12. We can, that's the parameters in which we get to operate in, that it can't be less than 12. Correct?
Correct.
So I could make a motion right now to accept your proposal as proposed, except have the minimum age be 18. And if someone seconded that, that would be a motion. So I just go ahead and make that a motion. Yeah, that's the way I roll.
So I do believe then we do have a motion from Brian, and to accept.
Yes.
The rule, the new rule, R65768, as presented, with the exception that the minimum age be 18 years of age. Do we have a second on that motion?
So we don't like the
18. So the motion.
We don't. Just
this motion fails just, because lack of a second.
Give me 2 seconds before we do that. So we don't like the idea of the 18 happen to be 18 years or older to do this.
I don't like the idea at all.
Mr. Chairman, may I address the safety concern with this bill or this rule? Mr. Woodbury, I have the same concern that you have on safety. That's my livelihood. That's what I've done for 23 plus years is hunter education, hunter safety. We currently have 450 volunteer hunter education instructors in the state of Utah. Every spring we travel the state, we have banquets for them, we have training sessions for them. So this year I presented this to all of our hunter education instructors in that format, and we had very open discussion, and number one is safety. And one question I asked them, and I'm going to ask you in the audience, is who taught you how to hunt safely? Who taught you gun safety?
It wasn't a hunter education teacher. It's my dad.
Hunter education
and safety are two. It's a lifelong process.
Okay, we need to call this meeting to order. We're still at comments from the rack right now. Do we have any further comments?
I'm just old enough. I remember the pre-65 days when there was actual charts in the newspapers and the TVs of how many people were killed that deer hunt. I still remember that and how dramatically it's dropped since hunter education.
Hey, Claire, and I...
And you have the ability to make a motion that we don't accept this rule, if so be it.
You know, I feel strongly enough about it. I will make that motion that we reject this ruling, or this motion, or this, what do you call it, recommendation.
Okay. Do we have a second on Claire's motion? Okay, so we have a motion from Claire that we do not accept the new rule, R657-68, and a second on a motion. Do we have any discussion on the motion?
I've got some, just a little bit. I mean, if we're talking about 50 incidents per how many? And it drops to 11 per 1 million. Well, you got 32 other states that do it. And when I first heard about it, I was against it. I had the same jaw drop, knee jerk reaction that Claire's got over there. I understand, and I just wonder if there's no. I just think we base a ton of decisions in here on statistics. And. And I've heard you say, and I agree with you that before 64 days were bad, but you've elbowed me before and say, hey, it's not coffee shop biology here. And so I think those statistics say something. I mean, if you can recruit somebody that's in your office for an afternoon of dove hunting and you sit on a water hole and you're sitting right there holding their hand, it can be a great experience. And then next thing you know, you've got a hunter.
That first dove hunt, he fetches the doves for me, and then he'll go get his hunter education and the license.
Maybe. You know, and that's how it was for us growing up, Claire. We went when our parents couldn't keep us out of the field. You know, we grew up, that was a part of our heritage. Some of these guys don't have that. So it's a way of exposure. So anyways, that's all I've.
Any further discussion on the motion? Okay, let's have a vote. All those in favor of Claire's motion, show by the lift of hand. Three. All those opposed? Six. Motion fails. Well, we need a new motion.
Brian, you better remake your first motion, because if we're going to pass this, we better... do it your way, with the adults only.
Good heck. I get dirty-eyed 5 minutes ago, and now I'll go ahead and make the same motion as I did before, that we pass it with the minimum age being 18 years of age.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Do we have any discussion on the motion? All those in favor? That passes unanimous.
I'm just trying to get out of the meeting, guys.
Brian, this is the first time we've ever disagreed on anything. It was fun.
I'm going to go ahead and say, wait a minute. I'm going to go ahead and say this is the first time I've ever had a motion that passed unanimously.
After failing for a second.
After failing for a second. That's got to be a record, guys.
Maybe you should take up eating crow.
I think we all just did, didn't we?
Okay. The last item is other business. I just want to thank everybody for their attendance tonight, for your comments. Our next meeting will be July 29th, and that'll be at the Beaver High School. And hope that you can attend there. And there's no other business. We'll call this meeting adjourned.